The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. China's Xi meets with Russia's Putin. We'll hear from Senator Tom Cotton.
Joe Biden's weakness in his first 2 years in office have created what they see as new opportunities for advancing their shared interests.
Who's the winner? Who's the loser?
Putin and Xi look pretty good here, and the Biden administration and much of the West doesn't look all that good at the, as a result of these talks.
Plus, Tennessee Senator Blackburn on the fentanyl crisis.
Fentanyl is the fastest growing killer of kids under 18.
All this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And please follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. And follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. On Monday of this past week, the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party and President of the country, Xi Jinping, arrived in Moscow for meetings with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The context, of course, is Russia's unprovoked war upon Ukraine over 1 year ago now. We'll turn first to Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, a regular guest on my radio show. Senator Cotton, I want to start with the biggest story of the week, the month, and the year. Xi and Putin together again in Moscow. How ominous is that gathering and the cementing of that alliance in your eyes?
Well, it's very worrisome, Hugh. I want to be clear, Joe Biden didn't bring these two together. They are anti-American dictators who want to overturn an American-led global order of security and stability that serves our interests and replace it with one that serves their interests. However, Joe Biden's weakness in his first 2 years in office have created what they see as new opportunities for advancing their shared interests, whether it was the appeasement of China and Russia both early in the administration, the fiasco in Afghanistan, or now Joe Biden's halting half measures in Ukraine. Time and again, Joe Biden has encouraged these two anti-American dictators to act on their long shared interests in undermining America's national security and the global order that advances America's interests as opposed to the anti-American interests of countries like China and Russia and others.
You're friends with everyone in the Republican Party. You are the hawk's hawk. What are you telling everyone, left, right, and center in the Republican Party? Isolationist to full-on Iraq war invasion was a good idea. What are you telling them all about right now?
But right now is a very dangerous moment, in part because so many of our friends around the world question whether or not America will uphold our security commitments, will defend our interests, as opposed to continuing to appease and conciliate and kowtow to Beijing in particular, but also adversaries as well. Like you mentioned, Iran. I was just in the region last month, and there are serious questions about whether America will not only defend our friends in the region, but even defend ourselves. If you look at the number of attacks that have been launched against Americans who are in places like Iraq, for instance, by Iran, without any retaliation for those Iranian provocations. So you see cases where not only anti-American dictators are coming together to forge stronger partnerships to undermine America's interests, but even friendly nations like Saudi Arabia have normalized their diplomatic relations with Iran for the first time since 2016 in a deal that was brokered by Beijing. It's pretty remarkable that we came out of President Trump's administration hoping for a peace deal between Israel and Saudi Arabia, and what we got was a diplomatic normalization between Iran and Saudi Arabia brokered by China.
It is this, the growing alliance between Russia and China, as well as the broader realignment of the world order that we had better be paying very close attention to. Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, now retired from the United States Army, joined Joe Piscopo, my colleague on AM 970, The Answer in New York.
We've pushed Russia and China together. China's going to run the world. Could you break it down for us? Because this is a dangerous time for the United States, yes?
Yes, you're correct, Joe. We have firmly aligned China and Russia on a host of issues. It was a political win in the last couple of days for both President Xi and Putin. Clearly, Xi pushed back at the United States, and now he enjoys really an image as a global statesman in the wake of what happened with the Saudi Arabians and the Iranians and their agreement that is bringing the Middle East under China's umbrella. And then, of course, Putin, brings in arguably one, if not the most powerful person in the world to Moscow for a couple days of consultation. That looks good for him. And, of course, in the wake of the International Criminal Court, yes. That kind of makes that look kind of bad.
I just wrote down the note, the ICC, and you just said it. The guy's getting an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court against Putin for war crimes. And then Xi still goes over. Your plane can't just make this up, sir.
Yeah, well, it's pushback, obviously. They're ignoring that. And that's how tyrants and authoritarians work. You know, I think in the out brief or the joint statement issued by the two leaders, that Xi was calling and consistently for diversity of civilizations. Really what he means there is he seeks a new paradigm for international relations. He wants to do away with the Western orientation of world community and impose his authoritarian view. And I think that's what Putin would enjoy as well. Now, economically, it's interesting that they didn't make a lot of progress, though they confirm that they're certainly have an enduring economic partnership. Putin wants to sell more gas to the Chinese. He promised 98 billion cubic meters of gas by 2030, and he promises to build the Siberian 2 gas pipeline through Mongolia into China. Apparently, Xi didn't buy it yet, but I think eventually that they will. On the Ukraine front, which is, of course, one that everybody's talking about, there's no real evidence that China has agreed to provide lethal aid to the Russians for the continuation here. But he did criticize the West for continuing to bolster Ukraine. He, of course, is expected in the next couple of weeks to call Zelensky and say, look, I have this 12-point peace plan. Let's sit down. Let's talk about this. Unfortunately for Zelensky, it doesn't return the territory seized by Putin in the Donbas area, much less the Crimea. So that may be a non-starter, but we'll have to wait and see. So there are a lot of outcomes here. I think that for the most part, Putin and Xi look pretty good here, and the Biden administration and much of the West doesn't look all that good at the as a result of these talks.
Does Ukraine come out of this? I mean, are we being fooled that Ukraine is making headway? Is this going to turn into another Vietnam type war, Afghanistan type war, where just a never ending war?
Well, certainly it could continue for some good long time. Evidence from the U.S. administration is that we'll continue to support Ukraine in its efforts. We're emptying our own arsenals in order to provide them with the latest technology. And, of course, we're accelerating the delivery of tanks, according to the secretary. So it would appear as if we anticipate this is going to last yet longer. I think because of the response by Russia today, as soon as Xi's airplane left Moscow, the Russians lost a host of drones against targets. Most were shut down, but there were people killed and buildings destroyed. So I think that's what Putin is basically saying about this peace agreement that Mr. Xi has offered. But Zelensky may not have a choice, because I think that there's going to be some external pressure, and not from obviously the West, but from a host of other players, that he may actually sit down with Xi, virtually, likely not face to face, and try to work out some sort of agreement. But I think in the broader sense here, Joe, what we're seeing is a power play, and a power play by Xi, of course. to establish what I said earlier, the new paradigm for international relations. And we are indeed in a new Cold War. You know, I said that 6 years ago in Alliance of Evil, my book in that year. And then, of course, here recently in Kings of the East, I said, look, China is a major player in this world. It's trying to manipulate the world environment. And every evidence, and I've outlined 16 indicators of this new Cold War, and we have to recognize things are changed from what they were a couple of years ago. We have to get serious about what's going on.
You know, and again, you know this better than most, and you use the term emptying our own arsenal, is what you said, Lieutenant Colonel McGinnis. So we're like depleting our military to give to Ukraine. It seems to be like a setup, like we're you know, that is China planning this? Is Russia planning this to weaken us to a point where they will take over?
Well, it's certainly part of a playbook that they've, you know, got us decisively engaged in supplying very sophisticated weapons to the Ukrainians. Mr. Biden issued an executive order weeks ago on the Defense Industrial Act, which accelerates our effort to, you know, supply our armed forces with hypersonic weapons, which both the Chinese and the Russians have already deployed. So that's a concern. And then, of course, the new Defense Authorization Act that they're now negotiating, you know, really ups the industrial base to produce far more weaponry. And, of course, we're buying weapons from other nations around the world so we can keep supplying the Ukrainians. So we need to recognize that, yes, Ukraine is draining our arsenals, and that has implications for what we're facing in the Far East with Taiwan. Taiwan is of national interest because it makes 90% of all the microchips in the world, and if China takes over, then it cripples the industrial West. So these are all interconnected, and we can't ignore what's going on in downtown Moscow, much less in Beijing.
You really think that Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, and Xi, the president of Communist China, they're going to talk? There's a possibility that Xi will broker a peace on behalf of Putin, and it would be China that would bring the peace and end the war, the conflict between Ukraine and Russia.
Well, I'm very optimistic that that's possible, but it's not going to behoove us if that is the outcome, because, you know, Xi is going to walk away as a more powerful leader globally. He already has a major footprint, and we need to recognize that.
Coming up, the scourge, the fentanyl.
Fentanyl is the fastest growing killer of kids under 18.
Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Celebrating our 25th anniversary, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy invites you to learn from one of our beloved teachers, Dr. Gordon Lloyd, in a four-part webinar series titled The Roots of Political Economy, Capitalism versus Socialism. This free video series teaches foundational principles of free markets, as well as the philosophers behind socialism. Find out more at go.pepperdine.edu/capitalism. That's go.pepperdine.edu/capitalism.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. It seems like every two or three days you hear some other tragic story of a life cut short as a result of the deadly and wicked opioid crisis. It's fueling our homeless crisis, and the problem is getting worse, not better. Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn is trying to get the Biden administration to wake up. She was a guest on the Trish Regan Show.
If we don't have enough people dealing with the fentanyl crisis coming from China, what's the reality and upshot of that?
And the upshot should be that Joe Biden picks up the phone and calls Xi Jinping and says, hey, buddy, you know that $1 trillion trade deficit we had with you last year? That's going to stop if you don't cut it out when it comes to this fentanyl that you are manufacturing and you've buddied up with the cartels, we know what you're doing, you're sending it across our border and it is adversely impacting so many of our communities. And by the way, we're going to run the cartels out of this country. But Joe Biden won't do that. Because it appears the more we learn that Joe Biden, his family, and Biden Incorporated are compromised on some fronts. So the Chinese Communist Party does not fear him. And they feel like they can go in with Russia, Iran, North Korea. They've created what I call the new axis of evil. They can go into partnership with the cartels when it comes to having someone to distribute this fentanyl, and that this is a way to target our people. And you know, Trish, when you look at what they're doing with the Chinese Communist Party, fentanyl is the number one killer of Americans age 18 to 45. Fentanyl is the fastest growing killer of kids under 18. You also look at what is happening to young girls, especially, but to all children because of TikTok and the garbage that is spewed, the way they are building a virtual you of these children. They're putting them in touch with the drug dealers who are working with the cartels, getting that those drugs from across the border and selling it to these kids. Where do these kids meet these drug dealers? On social media, with its TikTok, Snapchat, some of the affiliations they're making in these online games. So
they're destroying us from within. Let's just be very clear here. Senator Blackburn, you are spot on. And there are a lot of people that, oh, you know, they're clutching their pearls and, you know, they're all worried about this, that, and the other. There are people that will laugh at this. Well, there was, I believe, a New York Post reporter that went on TikTok the other day pretending she was a 13-year-old boy to see what kind of stuff she would get fed. The violence, the sexual, you know, pornography-like stuff that she saw. They kept feeding it and feeding it and feeding it and feeding it. And so I was thinking about this. I'm like, gosh, if you really want to destroy a society, why not go straight into the heart? Why not go straight to the youth? You hit them with those images, lots of guns, all of that, and not responsible gun ownership, lots of bad stuff. So you got that on TikTok, algorithms that really pollute the minds of young kids. And you simultaneously make sure that your fentanyl operations are feeding the drug cartels in Mexico that come right in to our country. I mean, it's like a it's like a perfect case study in how to destroy. And you don't even need to go to war.
That's right. And this is what they are trying to do. And they are, every town's a border town, every state a border state right now, because of what is happening. And it is heartbreaking to me to see these children that are so adversely impacted, the mental health issues. And, you know, Trish, when you have one girl that has mental health issues and is contemplating suicide on an ongoing basis, what does that do to her circle of friends? It adversely impacts and stresses all of them. And we have heard this story over and over and over and over again from parents, from principals, from classroom teachers, from pediatricians, from psychologists and psychiatrists who are working with these children. And you hit it with the algorithms that are in these social media platforms. If a child goes on and they are viewing something about mental health or depression or suicide or eating disorders, that algorithm feeds them more. It draws them down that path.
And by the way, they have an equivalent of TikTok in China, and you don't see any of this stuff on
that. That's right. It's an educational platform. It's like educational TV. You're right.
So what do? I mean, we tried to get rid of it before Donald Trump's administration tried to sell it to Larry Ellison from Oracle. I think that would have been a terrific idea. The deal didn't happen. How do we get rid of this company right now?
Well, there are a couple of things. Number one, Senator Blumenthal and I have bipartisan legislation we've worked on for 3 years now. It is the Kids Online Safety Act. And this is the legislation that would put in place a duty of care and some transparency and responsibilities for the social media platforms. It is past time for this to happen. The second thing is raising that age for kids to be on social media platforms. We as a society have decided that there are certain things that children are not able to do until a certain age. If you go buy a board game, there are recommended ages on that board game. If you are going to go see a movie, there are ratings on that movie. If you have a child who is 14 and wants to drive a car, you say no. You get a permit at 15. You get a license after you turn 16. We've decided that kids shouldn't be able to vote until they're 18 years of old, that they can't buy alcohol and tobacco until they're 21. But when it comes to these online platforms, they are trying to get kids at younger and younger ages and pull them in to these platforms and feed them this garbage. They are robbing our children of their childhood.
You know, there's the mental health issues. And then even this side of things, right, with some of the social media providers that really try and push a very, shall we say, woke agenda, or I just sometimes say, guys, like, really, what are you trying to do? You know, kids barely understand anything about these sexual issues and topics and romance. And I mean, they're kids. Like, come on, just let our kids be kids for a little bit. You suggested using all your economic tools. You talked about our trade deficit. There's a way to deal with China. I don't think we're being smart about it.
Well, because they do not fear Joe Biden. They see Joe Biden as weak. And the entire axis of evil, as I said, they are trying to expand their reach because they feel like if they're going to be globally dominant by the time we get to the midpoint of the century, that Joe Biden is giving them the running room to do that. I'm terribly worried about this.
You can get more of the Trish Regan Show at the Salem Podcast Network. Coming up, our naval weakness.
Command of the seas is a bit like oxygen. You don't really appreciate it until it disappears.
China Select Committee Chair Mike Gallagher. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Every day we hear news about violent assaults, carjackings, and other acts of crime spiraling across the United States. Washington's answer is to confiscate your guns, but a new book from Regnery offers hope for a better solution. Professional firearms instructor and veteran gun store owner Larry Correa's new book, In Defense of the Second Amendment, pulls back the curtain on Washington's gun-grabbing agenda and how you can protect your rights as well as your family. Get In Defense of the Second Amendment, new from Regnery, available at Amazon.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. We look at the growing threat from China today, and I want to take a step back now and look into China's fast-growing naval strength. What caught my attention was an essay in The Atlantic by Jerry Kendricks, a PhD but also a retired Navy captain. The title of the article, "The Age of American Naval Dominance is Over." The subtitle: the United States has ceded the ocean to its enemies. We can no longer take freedom of the seas for granted. I turn to Wisconsin Representative Mike Gallagher, chairman of the new Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party. What did you make of the essay? What do you make of the threat?
Well, first on the essay, I thought it was fantastic. It's a must-read essay for anyone who cares about national security. And Jerry makes some core points that I think your listeners will be familiar with, but need to be said to a wider audience. One, command of the seas is a bit like oxygen. You don't really appreciate it until it disappears. And then you really wish you'd invested in maintaining it. Two, we need something akin to a SHIPS Act that's just as aggressive, if not more, than the CHIPS Act that was just passed. And we really overall just need to have a sea power centric strategy to guide our Department of Defense efforts. We just played a war game that I led at the Republican conference. We did it on the first night. And I think it was illuminating for our members to see just how dire the situation is, how quickly we run out of ammo, and how much of a strategic liability our inability to rebuild the Navy is. And Jerry's essay, I think, captures that better than anything I've read in recent years. And so my hope is that our members, the Republican side, took away from that war game a sense that there are meaningful things we can do this Congress, start to replenish our stockpile of key munition system, like the long-range anti-ship missile, JASSM, and other SM-6 and other key missile systems. It was a very eye-opening experience, especially, I think, for those members who don't serve on national security committees.
Dr. Hendricks, in the essay in The Atlantic, said we're down to, you know, a dozen gravettes, the kind of piers that you need to build ships. Did anyone discuss that? And will you be holding a hearing for the Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party on the People's Liberation Army Navy? Because their extraordinary expansion brings to mind what the Kaiser did prior to World War One, and the teaming up of Putin and Xi brings to mind the 30s.
It does. And, you know, very quickly on Putin and Xi, because you asked at the outset, I mean, increasingly, we just have to see these two problem sets as connected. I think it would be geopolitical malpractice to try and isolate the problem with Russia and Putin from the problem of Xi Jinping and communist China, because obviously they're involved in a no-limits partnership, what I've called a new Cold War against us, and the collapse of deterrence in one theater affects the stability of deterrence in another theater. Yes, there was discussion about how we rebuild our Navy. Representative Whitman had the first question from the audience and talked about our inability after those first 7 days, because we only did one move. We did 7 days. We didn't finish the war. All right, well, now we got to move a bunch of stuff, men and materiel, from the continental United States into the Indo-Pacific. How are we going to do that? We don't have the ability to do that. As for the 60 Minutes piece, I was honored to participate with former Representative Elaine Loria, and I really think that 60 Minutes did a great job highlighting an issue that sometimes doesn't get highlighted outside our sea power circles. You know, one thing I've disagreed with Admiral Gilday on is that he'll point to the shipbuilders, to the shipbuilding industrial base, and say, well, hey, you guys got workforce constraints, you got supply chain constraints, you're limited in terms of what you can do. Well, those companies will say to him, we don't have a demand signal coming from the Navy such that we could start to make multi-year investments in our workforce, in our supply chain. You know, let me just go back and hammer one final thing here. That multi-year procurement authority, the ability to have a pot of money that transcends the budget fight every year, at least for key munitions and missile systems, is absolutely essential. For $10 billion or less, I believe we could seriously enhance our deterrent posture and prevent World War III, at least over the next couple of years.
Yeah, Representative Gallagher, the only way to persuade the American people is layering. But I would like to see your select committee focus on the PLAN, because driving home to Americans that they have vastly expanded their fleet faster than any fleet in history is an important point. And I don't know that Americans really understand just how big the Russian and Chinese threat is, particularly the latter on the blue water.
Our really sort of main mission is to explain to the American people why any of this matters, why they should care that we are ceding command of the seas, to use Dr. Hendricks' phrase, to our enemies, and why, therefore, we in Congress should do something about it over the next 2 years. It's getting that sort of communication piece right that allows us to fuel our policy and legislative agenda. A lot of our early hearings, and we're hoping to finalize our whole year's plan here soon, are focused on the nature of the threat. We're trying to explain why this is such a threat, a clear and present danger to the American people. And then we're going to be transitioning into two things. One, I call the sprint, the things we can do in the 118th Congress, even though it's a divided Congress, to actually meaningfully improve our position. And then the long-term marathon, the things we need to do over the next 10 to 20 to 30 years to win the next century, to make sure we don't lose that long-term marathon or new Cold War or whatever your phrase of the moment is.
Coming up.
You know, the Chinese Navy has tripled essentially in the last 15 years.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Celebrating our 25th anniversary, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy invites you to learn from one of our beloved teachers, Dr. Gordon Lloyd, in a four-part webinar series titled The Roots of Political Economy, Capitalism versus Socialism. This free video series teaches foundational principles of free markets, as well as the philosophers behind socialism. Find out more at go.pepperdine.edu/capitalism. That's go.pepperdine.edu/capitalism.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Weakness is provocative. That's a quote from the late Donald Rumsfeld. The Secretary of Defense from under both President Gerald Ford and President George W. Bush knew what he was talking about. That line should come to mind as we think about China, most immediately by our naval weakness and the aggressive investment we've seen from the CCP in their naval fleet. We turn now to Jerry Hendricks. This former Navy captain, PhD, and author of the piece in The Atlantic you heard me talking about, The Age of American Naval Dominance is Over, from my program earlier this week. Now, the unfortunate part, good news, bad news, is that Xi and Putin are meeting in Moscow this week. And 7 days ago, you published an essay that said either of those powers could shut down freedom of the seas in a moment, bring us into conflict, at which point the Navy's going to have to make some decisions. And you paint real world threats. Earlier today, Congressman Gallagher said they played a Chinese attack on Taiwan war game for 90 minutes at the GOP Congressional Caucus with your friend Admiral Montgomery providing commentary. Are you encouraged by, A, that The Atlantic wanted your article, B, 60 Minutes ran a story on sea power, and C, that the Republican caucuses are running war games?
I'm encouraged by all three of those items that you just mentioned. Obviously, as we look at Xi and Putin coming together, these are two great traditional continental powers. They're land powers that share a long border between each other. Both of those nations have always viewed the sea suspiciously because the sea is a medium for the free exchange of commerce. And the concept of freedom and the exchange of free ideas is something that they look very nervously on, which is one of the reasons why both of them have sought to control the seas and the oceans around them. Russia's been very focused on the Baltic and the Black Sea and now the Arctic over the last 50 years. China has now looked at the East China Sea and the South China Sea and essentially has laid these territorial claims as if they are internal waters. And of course, this is a threat to the very concept of the free sea, which is sort of foundational to the Western Enlightenment and to the way that the globalized system that the United States has spent 70 years building. So seeing them together makes me very nervous because they have a lot of potential power. They can do a lot of damage to the international economic system if they act together.
You know, now you anticipate the criticism in your essay in The Atlantic by that people are going to say, well, we don't have a lot of buggies and horsewhips around anymore either. So going from 6,900 ships to 271 doesn't matter. But Jerry, it does matter. And would you explain to people why we are now below the critical line? I think we've kind of flatlined.
Yeah. So, Hugh, I'm going to make a slight adjustment in your numbers. So we had 6,700 at the end of World War II. You're correct. We came down to about 1,000 ships during the Eisenhower administration, and we remained steady state through about 1969. And then Vietnam sort of began to eat into the naval budget at that point in time. So we dropped down during the Ford and Carter administrations. Reagan rebuilds us to nearly 600. And then essentially after the Cold War, we declared those peace dividends and we just started cashing in. So we cut 100 ships in the first year after the end of the Cold War. And we bottomed out at 271 during the Obama administration. There were some slight incremental changes. I checked this morning. The fleet's at 296. But the point that I make here is that when you dropped below 300, that was a go signal to China. You can look at their investments. You can look at the time when they changed their strategy. That occurred in the late 1990s, early 2000s, when the U.S. Navy dropped below 300. And China and Russia, to a certain extent, made the decision that, okay, the Americans aren't paying attention to the great oceans, the global commons. Now is our time to make our move. So they began to invest. And as the 60 Minutes report made the point, you know, the Chinese Navy has tripled essentially in the last 15 years, tripled in size, and is tremendously more modern.
Now, Captain Hendricks, you also point out our capacity to build and repair has plummeted. I didn't know the word gravette. Am I pronouncing it correctly? Gravette? Is it gravette? I don't know what it is, but I know we haven't got them.
I think you're talking about graving docks there.
Yes.
And essentially those graving docks, those are the golden goose. Those are the things that lay the eggs, and the eggs are these ships. And if you don't have graving docks, then you don't have ships. And
explain so what they are.
Cut back on. Yeah, so a graving dock is simply a place where a ship is assembled. So it's a large industrial construction site, and obviously it has to have access to the water, because when the ship is finally ready to be launched, it's going to have to slide out in the water. But these things have to be very large. They're very, they've got huge foundations. They can bear great amounts of weight. Obviously, the four-class aircraft carrier weighs in at 100,000 tons. So you have to have something that can hold that. You build it within it, and then you flood it, and you float the ships out at the end. During World War II, we had over 50 of these that could service ships or build ships of a length of 150 meters or greater. Today, you know, we're down to around 20, 23, with only 12 of them being certified for the Navy's use. So it's a tremendous cutback in the industrial capacity of the United States, not just to build ships, Hugh, but to repair them. And this is a point I made in the essay as well. We no longer have the capacity to repair the ships that we have. Almost a third of our submarine force is sidelined right now, waiting access to these graving docks, these repair yards, where they can be brought in and serviced. And when you got a third of your fleet on the sidelines, you're not ready for battle. And the enemy is watching.
So, Jerry Hendricks, you advocate for a Ships Act to accompany the Chips Act. Congressman Gallagher echoed that call for a Ships Act. What would be in it? Because a lot of Republicans are skeptical of spending money right now, given our $31 trillion debt. What would be in a Ships Act?
Well, I think we'd have to make a major investment in the industrial base, and we have to make a wise investment. We have to go back almost to the Eisenhower dispersal policy type of investment, where we began to make decisions about where we need to have additional capacity so that we could be safe in a time of war. You want to think about where you're going to be vulnerable in that time of war. So I raise in the essay that during World War II, you know, we built a lot of ships on the Mississippi River, on the Ohio River. We even built submarines on Lake Michigan and then floated them out through the Chicago River to the Mississippi and down. We need to think about building where the workers are. That's one of the major challenges that we have today, is where is your blue-collar workforce located? And then you sort of have to try to figure out a plan to go to them. We are building on the East Coast. We have some construction capacity in San Diego. We have a yard up in Bremerton, Washington, that's been sidelined because of EPA regulations. So there's four dry docks up there that we can't even access right now. We need to kind of go and build where we can right now. And that's why I think we have the Ships Act, where we have an industrial policy to make targeted investments in smaller yards in order to increase their capacity to get us ready for war.
Coming up.
This was a mistake that we made in many ways when we pulled back from sort of supporting our own shipbuilding economy.
More with Jerry Hendricks in the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Gino Geraci. This week in the Christian Outlook, sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, while other developed nations step back from transgender ideology, we are pressing full steam ahead.
In the case of Biden, he's using the full power of the Justice Department to force this ideology in schools all over the country.
We'll hear from Albert Mohler with a biblical understanding of it all.
It is against nature.
With failing banks and economic angst, we'll get pastoral perspective.
He says, be of good cheer. I have overcome the world.
And economist Jerry Boyer.
This is the intersection of bad finance and bad leadership.
All this and more. Be sure to join us.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. It's pretty difficult to overstate the importance of this week's meeting between the General Secretary of the Communist Party and President of China, Xi, and Russian President Putin. The question emerges, with what we know about China's capability and our own assets and capabilities right now, what is our vulnerability? Let's pick up with more of my conversation with Jerry Hendricks. Jerry, assume for a moment that hypersonics is all the threat that it is, plus more. And the Chinese People's Liberation Army Navy wanted to make a Pearl Harbor-like strike that was non-nuclear. They could hit our carriers, but how many different shipyards would they have to hit with hypersonics to put us, basically paralyze our ability to stay at sea?
Well, you heard the CNO say during the 60 Minutes interview that essentially we're dependent upon 7 shipyards. You know, we can, I know where they're at, and so do the Chinese. And so the idea that they would be able to target them. Now, the most difficult shipyards to reach are the ones that are farthest from Chinese access. So obviously you think about Guam, you think about Pearl Harbor, then you come down to San Diego. Those are a little less vulnerable. Then you think about the Gulf Coast and the Atlantic. Those are less vulnerable because the Chinese have to work harder to get there. I like the idea of, you know, where we're building the frigate, which is up in Marinette, Wisconsin.
I want to close by hearing your thoughts on what Xi and Putin would be talking about.
They're talking about, one, how are they going to set up a more robust, you know, transportation system to be able to move men and material and supplies, mostly supplies, from China to Putin right now, because he's having real difficulties with troop generation and some of his ordnance. He's starting to run out of things like 155 rounds. So can the Chinese provide him that? Also, China's looking at Putin and saying, I need more energy for my economy. I can't depend on the energy that's coming out of the Middle East. Can you give me more out of your northern energy supplies? And so Putin's starting to talk about supply lines going through the Arctic Ocean and then down around Asia and then into Chinese ports. So I think that they're having that idea of sort of building this system of military exchange, technological exchange, and energy and commercial exchange. They're sort of knitting together this alliance, which, by the way, I think is something that we've seen coming for a while. They're going to have to come together before they grow apart, and they will grow apart eventually because the Russians hate to be thought as a subservient power to China, and that's very much what they are. They are the junior partner, as Xi said.
What did we think they were doing?
Well, this was a mistake that we made in many ways. When we pulled back from sort of supporting our own shipbuilding economy, essentially that allowed others to step in. So Asian shipbuilders in Japan, South Korea, and China. China's the largest shipbuilder in the world. They are producing more ships than the other great shipbuilding countries together, you know, combined.
Wow.
In fact, one Chinese shipyard, and there's 19 of them, one Chinese shipyard has more capacity than all American shipyards combined.
Thank you for joining the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. And please take a moment to sign up for our podcast. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schumann, producers David Bouchon, Michael Cook, Tim Gantner, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.